We're delighted to welcome with us this morning homeschool students. Would they please stand? It's good seeing you. What community are you from? Madison? Milwaukee? Madison? Good. Please be seated. Students are here with our with class program. This is a program devised and run by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students from all around the state to join us for an oral argument. The students are given briefs and materials about the case and studied up on it, and then come to listen to the oral arguments. And at noon, the students will meet with a justice of this court. And today that justice sits on the far left of the bench, and it's Justice Justice Patience Rogensack. So you will, if you're able, will meet with Justice Rogensack at about noon to 12:15 when the second case will conclude, and you will be joined by students from Branton High School. Let me introduce the remaining members of the court to you. You've met Justice Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And in the empty chair, ordinarily, would be seated Justice Diane Sykes. We will hear, in this case, 02-2106, in the interest of Cesar G. We'll begin with Attorney Eileen Hirsch, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Cesar G.
Good morning. The first issue in this case is whether a juvenile court judge has the authority to stay a sex offender registration disposition. It's an issue of statutory construction reviewed de novo. Cesar G's position is that the juvenile court judge has that authority for four reasons I will summarize briefly. First, the language of the statute. Section 93834 creates a long list of dispositions for juvenile delinquency adjudications. And the last subsection of 93834, parent 16, authorizes the juvenile court specifically to stay any disposition without any limitation or exception set forth in that statute. Second, the legislative history shows that sex offender registration was a part of the Juvenile Justice Code prior to 1995 when the stay authority was added by the legislature. The legislature is, of course, presumed to be aware of existing law, and therefore its decision not to exempt 15M from the stay authority is presumed to be an intentional decision by the legislature. Third, the authority to stay sex offender registration is consistent with a core purpose of the Juvenile Justice Code, that dispositions should be tailored to the needs of the individual and society under the circumstances of the particular case, rather than determined by the heading on the crime. This court reaffirmed that purpose in In re Hezzy R, both generally and specifically as to sex offender registration, saying registration would only be required where the particular facts of the case and concerns for public safety dictate it. Fourth, the statutory construction proposed by Cesar G is one that follows the rule that statutes in peri materia are to be construed in a way which harmonizes them to give each full force and effect. In this case, it's important to remember that what we're talking about is a stay, a practically and analytically separate order from the first order in the case, which is the order to impose sex offender registration. And then a second order is entered staying that based on conditions set forth in the order. And so the juvenile court then complies with the requirements of Section 15M first, and then stays that order under Parent 16, therefore giving both of those statutes full force and effect. The second question in the case is what criteria the juvenile court should employ in exercising its discretion to stay the sex offender registration. Cesar G.'s position on that is that the criteria set forth in Section 938.34.15.M.C. are appropriate and that no burden of proof needs to be allocated based on that. What we're requesting in this court is that the court remand the case to the trial court for a discretionary decision on the issue of the stay. Now, I think what I want to do with...
Could you explain the disposition that you're looking for? There is pretty clear authority to require sex registration, sex Correct. Offender registration, and that was done here. So what... Explain a little bit more why you want this sent back. What's the theory?
Well, my theory is that, in this case, is that the trial court judge, when asked to stay that order, now, we're clearly up front not saying that the court should never have ordered sex offender registration. There should be a discretionary decision up front, or that it should be waived. We're not making any of those arguments. We're at the court, the request at the trial court was that it impose the sex offender registration order, the disposition, and then it stay that. And normally the requirements on the stay would be that Cesar G. would successfully complete his sex offender treatment, would successfully comply with whatever conditions the court puts on it. And normally those conditions are that he successfully completes his period of supervision and complies with all of the requirements given to him by the court. And that at the time, if he successfully completes his supervision, then the stay is never lifted and the requirement that he register would not be executed at that point. It is analytically separate. It says so in the statute. In Ray Kendall G. mentions that it's a second and separate order. It also is very practically different. And I think that sometimes if you look at the state's brief, they mix this up between the exception under 301.45.1M, a waiver decision, and a stay decision. But there's a real practical difference, which is that by doing the stay, the court gets to check his experience and see how he does for the next year, 2 years. It can even be up to age 17 or 18. To see if he commits any other violations, if he has any other behavior that violates any of the rules of supervision, and probably most importantly, that he complete his sex offender treatment. And so by giving that child time to comply with the order, to complete the treatment, the court, that's a very different thing than having to make a decision up front that this is not the kind of offense which would require sex offender registration.
Counsel, just so I understand your argument, what is the reason then for the seemingly mandatory language in 938.34.15.M.B.M., a juvenile court shall require the juvenile to comply with the reporting requirement? That seems to be mandatory, and is it logical to have mandatory language and then allow for a court to stay that? Just explain why that language would be there then.
Well, first of all, you have to remember that that language was enacted and it went into effect in 1993, December 25th in 1993. It was in 4834 and it was in 175. So you begin with that mandatory language. And then in 1995, and there are other mandatory parts, by the way, of the dispositional section. There's a mandatory DNA sample. There's some mandatory fees. There's a mandatory suspension of driver's license. But in 1995, the authors of the Juvenile Justice Code said, we want to give juvenile courts authority, more authority than they have now, to create this whole possibility of dispositions and to give them more flexibility to tailor a disposition that meets the needs of the individual before the court. And so they added this stay authority. And in that stay authority, they did not say for the discretionary dispositions, they didn't say for the placement dispositions, they said for all dispositions. And so I think you begin with, it begins with the presumption, the mandatory imposition of the stay, of the registration, as required by statute. But I think then there is a separate legislative decision that they are going to give in juvenile court the authority to the juvenile court judge to stay that mandatory disposition. And so the child then can earn the privilege of not registering as a sex offender by good behavior, successful completion of treatment, and showing that he or she is not the kind of person who should be on the registry in order to protect the public. And so it does begin, and I cannot argue, I would like to argue in front of this court that it's always discretionary in juvenile court whether you impose sex offender registration. I can't make that argument from the language of the statute. But, and that's, I wouldn't try to do that today. But I do think there is a separate decision about staying that order.
I'm sorry to be obtuse here, but even if there is complete discretion to issue a stay, it's not required.
No. Absolutely not. I agree.
And the judge didn't issue a stay here. So even if you win on the theory, why do you get to go back and have this disposed all over again?
That was the issue in the Court of Appeals. And what I argued in the Court of Appeals, if you go back to the language of the decision by the judge, and let me just pull that up specifically. The judge's decision included these words: although I've stayed that in one other case that I can recall by stipulation between defense counsel and the state, I am still not convinced that I have the statutory authority to stay that. And then the judge went on and said, under the circumstances, that will keep Cesar registered until he's 27 or 28 years old. I don't think that's unreasonable. I'm not going to stay execution of that. He shall register as a sexual offender. My argument in the Court of Appeals was that when the judge begins a decision by saying, I'm not sure I have the statutory authority to make this decision at all, that requires a clarification of the authority before the judge can actually make a valid discretionary decision. That by saying, well, I've done it in some cases, but I don't think I have the authority, the judge really wasn't exercising his discretion in this case. He was really basing his decision on his belief that he didn't have the authority. Now, the second issue also came out of the Court of Appeals decision, and it's the one that's before the court today, because the court only looked, and the Court of Appeals decision says, the seriousness of the offense was the driving factor in the trial judge's decision. And that goes to the second issue. The other issue we're asking for remand is because we're saying, the judge said, you know, if he were 17, this is a serious offense. If he were 17, he'd be looking at prison. Well, that's absolutely true. But what we're arguing is that the court has to look at other factors. It can't simply be based on the nature of the offense, that the court has to look at the other factors in making its discretionary decision. And so what we argued in the Court of Appeals really was, first, that the judge had actually decided it, believing that he didn't have authority, and second, that he had misused his discretion because he hadn't looked at any factor other than the seriousness of the offense. So that's why we're asking for the remand to the trial court.
Well, you did a motion for reconsideration at the trial court, at the Court of Appeals.
That's correct.
And your motion there was that Court of Appeals, in effect, I don't know what your motion was, but as I read these, the per curiam decision of the Court of Appeals didn't say anything about the trial court's hesitation about power.
That's right. It simply omitted that language.
That's right. And you said, wait a minute. And in an order, the Court of Appeals said, considered your motion, and we conclude that it's a fair interpretation of the circuit court statements to say that although the court questioned its authority to stay the registration requirement, it ultimately exercised its discretion to deny the requested stay. And that's what you disagree with, if I understand
your
argument. That's what you disagree with, but the court held against you, and what you're saying here is, one, I want to win on the law, because for the four reasons you gave, and two, I want to, if you agree with me on the law, you ought to send this back because you don't think that the trial court in effect exercised the discretion.
That's correct. That's correct.
That's your posture.
Yes, and I would add to all of this that there was I had raised a third issue on my petition for review, which was the way that the Court of Appeals handled this case. They said, actually, I said that I thought the issue was that the trial court had not exercised jurisdiction or its discretion because it had decided it didn't have the authority. The state replied that it did exercise its discretion, and when I then replied in my reply brief that it had misused its discretion, the Court of Appeals said it wasn't going to consider that argument and ruled against me. And so I raised a third issue here. This court decided not to take that issue. And so I really believed when we came here that there was the legal issue in this case is really the focus of this decision, which is whether the juvenile court does have the authority to stay the sex offender registration disposition. And that is what I'd really like to focus on today.
Ms. Hirsch, let me focus you on something else for a moment.
Okay.
You had mentioned the criteria, and you had looked at 938.34.15mc.
That's correct.
I didn't quite understand, at least not clearly, whether or not you and the state really have a disagreement as to whether seriousness of the offense should or should not be considered. In reading the briefs, you seem to shy away from that criteria, and the state seemed to try to emphasize it. Do you really have a disagreement, and if so, what is it?
I think that the disagreement between the state and our position here in this court is a very minor disagreement. Cesar G., clearly the seriousness of the offense is a criteria that needs to be considered for any disposition. The Chapter 938 says that repeatedly, and we would never argue that that's not a valid criterion. The only, and I think on that point we really don't disagree. I think the only, where I really disagree is with the Court of Appeals, which said it can be the only factor, the driving factor, that no other criterion have to even be considered. And I think there's also a fairly minor issue about whether there's a burden of proof that needs to be carried by the juvenile or whether it's just part of the regular dispositional decision. But I think that our disagreements on that are very minor.
So in other words, you would concede that along with the criteria that are set forth in the statute, that obviously seriousness of the offense is something else the judge is going to look at in exercising her or his discretion?
Absolutely. And I think failure to look at seriousness would be a misuse of discretion. I think that that's very clear in the statute. And I think that in this case, there is no question that this was a very serious offense. And I want to come back to this issue about the exception under 301.45.1M being different than the stay under 938.34.16, because I think this is it sort of describes the difference in the kinds of cases that come before the court. 301.45.1M is discussed a lot in the briefs. It's what was called the Kevin Gilson law. And that involved clearly described circumstances. Kevin Gilson was an adult and he was prosecuted as an adult. But that clearly was meant to accept teenagers who have a sexual relationship, a consensual sexual relationship. And there was a decision up front with that exception that is simply not the kind of crime. The person who is involved in that kind of crime is not the kind of person we need to put on the registry to protect the public from. And I think that that's clear and that makes sense. What happens in juvenile court is a very different kind of case, and I think it's really fairly well illustrated in this case. The most common juvenile court cases are 11 to 14-year-old boys. And sometimes their offenses, as in this case, are really serious offenses. And if they were 17, 18, 25, 40 years old, any judge would look at that and say, this is the kind of case where the perpetrator should be on the sex offender registry because we're afraid of what he'll do in the future. The one factor that makes a big difference in every one of these cases is not the kind of crime. It's that the fact that the perpetrator is 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, sometimes 10 years old. And in that case, What the juvenile court judge needs to do is needs to get a very thorough psychological assessment and needs some time to make a decision whether this child is, based on the kind of offense and the information you get about him, you can make a decision that it looks like the kind of case where this is going to happen once and it's not going to happen again, and he doesn't need to be on the registry. But by allowing a stay, you do two things. You make sure he successfully completes sex offender registration, which lowers the rate of recidivism, and you give him time to develop pro-social behaviors for a year, 2 years, 3 years, however long it takes that he's on supervision. He has to not violate his supervision and develop those pro-social behaviors. And so a stay allows the juvenile court to deal with a very different situation than is dealt with in the exception in 301.45. And that's why I think that difference between a stay and an exception to sex offender registration is important and is contemplated by the legislature with 938.34, parens 16.
Counselor, would you agree that section 938.34.15mc does not include someone who has been adjudicated under 15MBM? Do you see the problem I have because it refers only to AM?
I do. I agree with that.
And so that doesn't have any relevance to what we're talking about here today?
It doesn't have technical relevance. Mm-hmm. But if the court agrees that there's a stay authority, I think it's clear that these are the criteria that should be applied. They're also the same criteria that are in the exception in 301.45.
They are, but subsection C does not apply to where we are, which is BM.
That's correct. That's correct. And there's actually some interesting legislative history on that, which I think explains that. I mean, one of the state's arguments was if they had meant to allow the stay, they would have put the criteria in. Mm-hmm. But the legislative history on that is in 1995, when the stay was ordered in juvenile justice, those criteria did not exist. They weren't in 301.45, and they were not in 938.34. It was a more open, discretionary provision in 1995. Mm-hmm. The criteria in parent C were added in 1997, Act 130. And so I think that explains why they aren't specifically in the stay statute based on legislative history. I want to just mention there's some other interesting legislative history that I've learned about as I've gone through this. One is that after this first registration, there's no question the federal act did not require juveniles to be registered on the sex offender registry, but the Wisconsin legislature put that in 1993. Ever since then, though, every major decision by the legislature on the sex offender registration has slightly backed away on juveniles. And there's a trend. It's a trend. It shows in 1993 it applies across the board. 1995, there are two acts that come in. One is the Juvenile Justice Act, which adds the stay authority. I'm just going to find this. The other is 1995 Act 440, which was the notification law that added notification, but it did not add notification for juveniles. It kept the juvenile sex offender registration confidential. And so they made an exception for juveniles in 1995 with notification. In 1997, the Kevin Gilson law comes in. That backs off a little bit with the exemption for the kinds of cases we've talked about. And then in 1999, there was another Act 89. Which actually changed the JIPS disposition, 938.345, parens 3, from being mandatory to discretionary. And so since 1993, there is this trend in the legislature to slowly take little steps away from this overall treating juveniles exactly the same as adults. And so I think that the stay authority fits in well with the general legislative history on the sex offender registration statute as well. I think that if you don't have any questions right now, the other thing I would like to address is the Daniel T. decision.
That pending here?
Pardon?
Is that pending
yes,
here?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Cesar R. really didn't reach the substantive issue that the court's considering today. It did it based on discretion. And then Daniel T., the same Court of Appeals panel, decided that the court did not have did not have the stay authority that we're arguing today. The state included, and that was filed, the petition for review was filed. The court held it in abeyance pending the decision in this case. It's in the state's brief. Daniel T., I think, makes several really unexplainable errors, and one of which is that it says that when you look at 938.34, 15M, 16, and 301.45, that the more specific statute controls. And it decides that 301.45 is the more specific statute. I think that's based on clear and simple error. And the clear and simple error is, in paragraph 9, it says, when the court is confronted with a juvenile sex offender, the general juvenile justice statute refers courts to the specific statute of section 301.45 to discover the penalty. Well, it just isn't true. When the juvenile justice court, when a juvenile court has a juvenile sex offender, it goes to 938.34 to determine the disposition. Only if it orders the sex offender registration is there a referral to 301.45 for all of the general requirements of sex offender registration that apply to adults, to people in Chapter 51 cases, to everybody who has to register as a sex offender. And so I think that Daniel T., in determining that 301.45 is the more specific statute, is simply an error, and that clearly 938.34, 15M, and 16, when the issue is sex offender registration for juveniles in juvenile court, ordered by the juvenile court judge, is the more specific statute. I would point out one other error in Daniel T. The court hasn't asked about this, although the state argues it, which is this language about a condition of disposition. That it just doesn't make sense in the context of that.
Is a condition of disposition versus what, the adjudication or the...
Well, they talk about a condition of adjudication which doesn't follow through the statutory language. And Daniel T. actually says sex offender registration was a condition of his placement, which simply doesn't make any sense whatsoever, because he would have been required, they're not related. He could have been placed or not placed. He could have been ordered to register or not register, but there's not a relationship between those two. And so I think that court is in error on that one, too.
What bothers me is, among many things, seems to be, and maybe this is endemic, discrepancy. A co-defendant, or I use that word, but it's not quite accurate, does get a stay as to registration. Daniel T. did or didn't get a. The state, it's in a prosecuting attorney at the trial court level, and of course you've got 72 different offices. So what's happening around the state? I mean, I bet in some counties the prosecutor suggests the stay, joins, in fact, one of these, they join in a stay. Other counties, they fight it. What are the judges doing, and what's...
Well, until Daniel T., it was all over the place. And actually, in this case is a wonderful example. Actually, Tony, who was the leader in this offense, I think under anybody's version of the facts, didn't have to register.
And same trial court judge?
It was a different judge. County, different judge. But then this judge also says, in other cases where the parties agreed, I've granted those stays.
I saw that. That's
and,
where I got that
and
idea.
And we were just talking before the case that they were fairly common in some counties, never granted in others, rarely granted in others, and it's really been all over the board. And so partly this will be resolved by this decision today. There'll be some guidance from this court about what the authority and the criteria are.
Okay. Thank you. Shannon Wittenberger, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Shannon Wittenberger, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. Today I'm asking this court to find that the trial court does not have the authority to stay the sex offender registration requirement when a juvenile is adjudicated delinquent of a qualifying sex offense for two main reasons. First, that the sex offender registration statute does not provide for it under 301.45, and second, that it would be contrary to the legislative intent in enacting both the Juvenile Justice Code and the sex offender registration statute. 301.45 does control in this situation. It is the more specific statute when specifically referring to registration. And 301.45 is not triggered by 938.34 subsection 15M. It is triggered independently either by the adjudication of the juvenile or upon the juvenile being placed under supervision, a correctional facility, in a secured child caring institution, or a secured group home for sex offenses. So under 301.45, either of those things, either placement or the adjudication of delinquency, requires the juvenile to register. The only exception in 301.45 is the underage sexual activity situation where basically it's a voluntary act between two juveniles. However, in those cases, it's the juvenile's burden to show that it's not necessary in the interest of public protection for that juvenile to register, along with they have to be within 4 years of each other, and the victim has to be 12 years of age or older. Nowhere in 301.45 does the statute mention a stay or mention any other exception other than the teenage sex exception. Furthermore, it doesn't even mention 938.34, so under 15M. Therefore, 301.45 is clearly not dependent on the 938.34 15M BM language.
May I ask you a question? I want to try to understand your argument. Suppose someone is convicted or found delinquent because of an offense, and we're operating under 15M AM.
Yes.
Now, as I understand this, this gives the court discretion whether to require sex offender registration or not.
Correct.
But you are saying that placement is one of those things that kicks the statute in under 301.45.
It'd be placement pursuant to finding a delinquency for the sex offenses, whereas 15MAM deals with non-sex offenses where the court finds underlying sexual motive. So those are not covered under 301.45.
Okay.
So it would be placement for the underlying sex offense or the adjudication of that sex offense.
Well, let me ask this. Suppose Justice Bradley is sitting as a trial judge, and she's under AM, and she decides that she's going to require sex offender registration, and she issues an order to that effect as part of a whole series of orders. May she also issue a second order staying that?
I think under those circumstances, probably so, because it's not independently required under 301.45. However, I think practically speaking, the issue comes down to whether it's going to be ordered or not, and it's not going to come down to a stay issue. But I think because there's mandatory language in 15MBM, and because 301.45 independently requires the registration for the sex offenses, that under those cases, there is not the discretion to stay. But I also think one of the confusions in 938.34 is that subsection 16 indicates that a court may stay a dispositional order. It does not say that it may stay individual dispositions. And under 48.355, subsection 1, a dispositional order is defined as both a placement and a treatment. Under 48.355, it indicates that the court shall, as part of the dispositional order, order a placement and order conditions of treatment or treatment options. And therefore, that goes along with the language in the interest of Kendall G., which there are two orders that are actually implemented. And under both orders, there's going to be placement, and under both orders, there's going to be conditions and treatment options. And under either situation in this case, here Cesar G., a correctional order was stayed. Under 301.45, because he was found delinquent of a sex offense, he was required to register. The other order was formal supervision. And under that order that was actually implemented, independently 30145 requires registration. And therefore, I think the language in subsection 16 actually talks about a dispositional order and not necessarily individual dispositions.
So what kind of order requires that he be in the registry?
An order, it's triggered solely by the adjudication or by an order of placement.
I understand that. But what piece of paper says, thou shall register?
It would be the finding of adjudication for the sex offense. That would be under 30145. But also under that statute, the placement would also trigger it.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to find out. I know very little about juvenile law, so I'm not familiar with the forms. Will the order that places the juvenile and sets forth the condition and treatment, will that order say, thou shall register?
Yes.
Okay.
It'll be one of the many, along with requiring a DNA surcharge or a DNA sample.
Is it your position that the judge can stay various parts of the dispositional order?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that under subsection 16, the dispositional order is stayed.
Okay. So the dispositional order says you serve X number of months in Lincoln Hill, and you shall also get the following treatment. And your conditions at Lincoln Hill are going to be, and after you get out of Lincoln Hill, the conditions are, does he say that too? Does the judge say that?
Mm-hmm. Right, that they're such a sex offender treatment, that type of thing.
Okay. So if the judge wants to stay, the judge has to stay all of it?
Yes, I believe under the reading of subsection 16.
Okay, so now instead of going to Lincoln Hills, that stayed, where does he go?
Then has to implement another order that the juvenile is required to comply with, which again includes placement and conditions and
okay,
treatment.
So he's going to stay home. He's going to be under the supervision of his parents. He's going to report in X number of times. So on the implementation, why can't you also put in that he doesn't have to register unless he screws up?
I don't think that was legislative intent, and I don't think, because under each different order, under 30145, registration is required under both supervision or placement and corrections. I think it also is contrary to legislative intent in looking at the overhaul of the Juvenile Code in 1996.
The state's position is court has no discretion.
In this situation, yes, because of the mandatory language.
When does the court have discretion when a juvenile commits a sex offense?
If the juvenile...
Stay the registry.
To stay it?
Stay registration.
Under sex offenses, which would be the first degree, secondary, I don't believe the court has authority to stay it.
Okay. So, counsel, excuse me.
Sorry, go ahead.
In this case, as your opposing counsel indicated, Cody received a disparate sentence. In other words, it was stayed by a different judge. You had the similar conduct. We're all familiar with the facts. I don't want to go through that. And it seems to me, and I was thinking about, and you're aware of the Hesse case, correct?
Yes.
Now, in Hesse, and I was just reading part of that, it indicates that the juveniles, and this is by the court, fail to recognize that the reporting requirements may be waived. This is what Hesse says. Under Wisconsin Statutes 938-3415-MBM, a juvenile need not comply with the reporting requirements of 30545 if the court determines after hearing on a motion made by the juvenile that the juvenile is not required to comply under 301.45(1)(m). The requirements of 30145, therefore, are only imposed on a juvenile who is adjudicated delinquent where the particular facts of the case and concerns for public safety dictate it. But that, it seems to me that that is a, I'm not going to say a direct signal, but that you treat each case separately and that you can have different outcomes for one and another. Under it's up to the judge then, right? Which would mean there would be discretion.
I read that language, however, because the court directly cites 301.45.1M, which is the underage sexual activities exception, that the court's referring and distinguishing between Hezier's argument that it's punishment because they're treated the same as adults, as indicating that under 301.45.1M, that's not true, that there are specific circumstances where juveniles may be exempted from that requirement.
You would agree or maybe disagree. This is a major case because it's been done differently all around the state. In other words, and the effect of this case could be, what effect would this have if we were to say it's mandatory, you have to do it, on Tony's case?
Then the trial court would have been in error in Tony's case by not ordering it. And
vice versa, of course, if we go the other way, then there are a lot of other decisions. So either way.
Yes. My experience, I came from Waukee County District Attorney's Office, is in general, the DA's office did not believe they had the discretion, and in my experience, courts were not allowing it because they did not believe they had the discretion. But I know from speaking to other counties as a result of handling this case that other counties handle it differently, including the DA's offices.
Yeah, and here, it's right in the same case we have it handled differently.
Right.
Two different judges.
Right, and I think that actually lends itself to why it is a mandatory requirement, because if the legislature intended for this independent discretion, it would have listed what factors had to be considered. It took the great pains to list the factors for the exception or when it's a discretionary decision for non-sex offenses, but it didn't bother to list any kind of guidance to the trial court for a stay, which I think does end up in resulting in somewhat inconsistent determinations when you're talking about co-defendants.
Counsel, in this case, the facts indicate that he was adjudged delinquent at the ripe old age of 13. Of course, the juvenile code covers, as your opposing counsel notes, 10-year-olds. 10-year-olds are fourth or fifth graders, typically. Does it make sense to you to have a mandatory sex registration, a requirement for sex registration for fourth graders?
I think in certain cases, yes. And I think that's what the legislature did intend. Because
What do you mean, in certain cases? I thought your interpretation, mandatory and uncertain, in all cases involving a offense of this nature for fourth graders, it's your position all of them should be required to comply with sex registration. Is that correct?
Yes, unless they fall within the exception. I believe
a voluntary consent sex.
Yes. I believe if you look at the legislative history, that is
apply to 10-year-olds?
Pardon me?
Does that apply to 10-year-olds?
The
voluntary sex.
If the victim is 12 years of age or older, it can, yes.
Two 10-year-olds, you register the kid.
It wouldn't apply, correct. Mm-hmm. But the legislative...
Does that make sense? Two 10-year-olds, two fourth graders, does that make sense? Do you think the legislature intended that?
Yes, I do. I think that in 1996, the legislature revamped the juvenile code because of concerns of juveniles committing very serious offenses. And they lowered the age, as obviously you all know, to age 10 because of the concern that there are juveniles that young committing extremely serious offenses. And the offenses that they're required to report for are, you know, sexual offenses that are by force, by some violence involved. In this case, they held the girl down and sexually assaulted her. And I think it's a recognizing that there are juveniles, even as young as 10, that present serious risk to our community. And in 1996, this overhaul, the legislature clearly made a statement that we want public protection to be as important as rehabilitating the juvenile. And in certain situations, when the offense is so serious, we have to treat them in a different way. It's the same thing with original jurisdiction for first-degree intentional homicide, second-degree intentional and reckless. Juveniles as young as 10 start out in adult court solely based on because of the offense itself. And when the legislature has allowed for any reverse waiver for certain juveniles, they've clearly stated the factors involved and whose burden it is, and in that case, the juvenile's burden. And that also goes along here, that when the legislature allowed for any exception, they clearly stated the factors involved and whose burden it is, the juvenile's. And so if the legislature intended the state to apply in these situations, I think it would have been more specific as to the factors that would be consistent with the statutory scheme.
Counsel, you're getting into, and in response to Justice Bradley's questions, some policy issues. And let me just try this out on you. When you look at the new juvenile code, the code that was went into effect in 1996, you've got a situation where the legislature is creating a whole series of dispositions and basically saying to the judge, as I think Ms. Hirsch argued, that the judge can exercise discretion in deciding what fits for this particular juvenile under all of the circumstances. Now, given that approach, doesn't it make sense to say that there's some discretion in the judge as to whether or not to require sexual offender registration?
From looking at the legislative history, it's my understanding subsection 16 was actually implemented to allow judges the ability to stay correctional orders. And then along with 1996, there were numerous other dispositions added, such as the youth village, the serious juvenile offender program was somewhat changed, and so there are numerous other dispositions. So I agree that was part of the purpose. But subsection 16 from articles that have been written and from two unpublished cases that said trial courts, you are not allowed to stay correctional orders. And it was clear that trial courts wanted to do that, to have that hammer hanging over the juvenile's head. And subsection 16 wasn't a response to those issues and not in directly addressing the sex offender registration. If the legislature intended for a case-by-case analysis in every sex offense case, no matter how serious, the legislature would have simply stated under subsection 15 MBM that the juvenile shall report unless it's not in the interest of public protection. And the legislature clearly did not do that. The legislature kept intact 30145 and the mandatory requirements except under the specific exception under 30145-1M.
But your opposing counsel, as I understand it, is not advancing the argument that they can be relieved, that in the first instance they don't have to register. I understand under the 15M argument that your opposing counsel says they do have to register. The language says as it is. The focus, instead, is not whether there is an order for registration. The court shall require the juvenile to comply with the reporting requirement. So I think there's no disagreement on that. The disagreement, as I understand it, comes with regard to whether or not the court has authority in the second instance to stay the order that it initially entered. Is that your understanding of the different positions here?
Yes, I would agree with that. This court has also asked us to address the what factors we'd like the court to consider if the court does agree with Cesar G's argument. And I do agree, and I think we are not very far apart, as this court has indicated, that we agree that it should be the same factors under 15M subsection C, which are the same ones in 30145, although I would ask that seriousness of the offense obviously be included, because in the court, when it legislature, when it has wanted to distinguish between the serious nature of the offense, it has distinguished by mandating the requirement. But I'd also ask that it be the juvenile's burden, because this would mean, and although I understand that a stay and a permanent exception are different, I think we have to look at the end result, that they end up being the same. If a juvenile is placed on a year order, placement at home, complies with his conditions, it ends up in being a permanent exception. So,
and if he doesn't comply with the conditions?
Then he would be required to report. But if that would mean that a juvenile would have an easier time obtaining a stay of the sex offender registration requirement when he or she has committed the most serious offense, first-degree sexual assault. However, a juvenile that was trying to obtain the exception under 301.45.1M for a less serious, a second-degree sexual assault of a child, two 15-year-olds otherwise consenting, in that case, the burden is on the juvenile to show that it's not necessary in the interest of protection. And therefore, I think that it would be inconsistent to interpret the stay as being no burden, but the exception for less serious offenses requiring the burden be on the juvenile. And I think it would also be consistent with the legislative history of 301.45. It's clear that this is not intended to be a punishment, and this Court has found it's not a punishment in Balig, but this is intended to be for public protection. And the 301.45 triggers 301.46, which is the notification procedures. And the legislature has indicated that when we want the juvenile to be treated differently, we specifically state, because in the notification procedures, the information cannot be disseminated to the general public.
Also, what should the burden be? You're asking that the burden be on the juvenile. What should it be, in your opinion?
Clear and convincing evidence, which is the same burden under 301.45.1M. The juvenile under the notification procedure is protected in the sense that the general public cannot obtain the information. The local law enforcement agency of that area can, but they can then not give it to the general public, and the victim in the case can.
Well, does that fit with a registry? The registry has the full name?
They're limited in the information they can provide when it comes to juveniles. The registry will can publish the information as to adults, but not as to juveniles.
So we have a registry that the juvenile isn't registered in?
They're registered on, but that information cannot be provided to the public, can only be provided to the law enforcement agency.
So if I went to the registry on the Internet, I could not find any juvenile. Is that right?
That is my understanding, yes.
Where does it say that in the statute?
Under 301.46. When it gets into notification procedures.
And that notification includes the registry then?
I believe it does.
Okay. I'll look that up. I just assumed that since we're fighting about a registry, that it's public, just like the registry is.
No, I believe the purpose of the registry is the gathering of information. That information then, all of it for adults and juveniles, is provided to law enforcement in the community, but then it can only then further be provided to the general public for adults. So it clearly is consistent with the juvenile code of treating juveniles differently and protecting them from some of the other consequences that may indirectly flow from the requirement.
Counselor, do you know that if you're right and the registry for juveniles is available only to law enforcement, though it can be effective for 15 years, does some disposition happen to it when the juvenile becomes an adult if he or she has not had further violations, or does it convert into a public registry at that point?
It remains a private because the language in the statute indicates if the person is required to register under 301.45 as an adult, any information concerning a juvenile proceeding in which the person was involved cannot be given. So the protection functions as a result of when the adjudication occurred or what.
So just like any other kind of delinquency adjudication?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is the registry posted on the Internet?
I don't believe at this point it is posted on the Internet. I believe what occurs is it's given to the law enforcement agency, and then they can the 30146 indicates specific language when it can be further given out when it's necessary in the public protection. I don't think it's done in a general manner.
And you're talking about the juvenile registry. You're not talking about the adult, as far as the Internet.
Right. And I'm not – when I went on the website for Department of Corrections, I did not find the registry for adults or juveniles. But I couldn't be mistaken as to the adults. But I do know, according to the statute, that it was not public knowledge for the juveniles. And I believe that this is consistent with the legislature indicating that when we are going to treat juveniles differently and when we believe juvenile protections need to trump or be more important than public protection, the legislature specifically states so. But it has repeatedly in the juvenile code, when the legislature feels that the crime itself is so serious that we need to treat the juveniles in a certain manner as a result of that crime, such as mandating the sex offender registration, that it does require that in certain situations. But it's only in very specific situations. It's not the majority of cases that go before juvenile court. It's only in specific, the most serious sex offenses, which are those along with homicides are the most serious offenses we have in our community, and put the public in general at the most risk.
When you said that juveniles don't go on the Internet registry, you said 30146? 30146 what?
30146. Under subsection 4, AG, it indicates the department may not provide any of the following in response to a request under paragraph A, any information concerning a child who is required to register under 30145, or any information if the person is now adult, if it was a juvenile adjudication. So, therefore, the department, who is the one that runs the registry, is limited by that statute in their ability to provide the information.
Now, if there wasn't, the child wasn't on the registry, could the information about the child be released to law enforcement?
I don't believe that there would be any mechanism, although the juvenile code has informed schools when a juvenile is found delinquent of certain offenses, but I don't believe that that relates to, I believe that just relates to schools and not law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole issue of the confidentiality of juvenile records and to whom reports may be made is of great concern, and the Department of Justice and the Director of State Court's Office under the Court Improvement Program has a project looking into these confidentiality in an attempt to try and conform these statutes. So I just put that in the hopper for whatever light you can throw on that issue.
Well, I believe that 30146 is consistent with the juvenile code in saying that this information should not be given to the general public, that in certain situations we do need to treat the juveniles differently.
But counsel, law enforcement would have access to the juvenile records. Maybe I got the wrong impression, but if it happens in Winnebago County, certainly Outagamie County would have the ability to get that information. Maybe I misinterpreted what you said, but I understood that it's not shared with law enforcement.
Under the juvenile statute, I know that upon adjudication for certain offenses, that the court automatically gives the information to certain schools if the juvenile is there. But obviously, the law enforcement agency of that county that was involved in that investigation has access to information.
But it can't be, okay.
But I believe it would be a situation if a juvenile would move from Winnebago to Milwaukee County, that in general that information would not be released to Milwaukee County when the juvenile moves after his or her adjudication. But under the sex offender registration, that information would go to Milwaukee County because it's based on where the juvenile lives.
how does the department, which is the entity that is focused on in sub 4 that you refer to in 301.46 sub 4, AG 1 and 2, how does the department disseminate sex registry information about juveniles to law enforcement agencies? In a quick read, I am not able to answer that question, a quick read of the provisions regarding notification. So can you advise me of that?
I believe it's just by bulletin that they give the information that is required to register by bulletin to the law enforcement agency, which would include the information of the juvenile's name, where the juvenile lives.
So the department sends out a statewide bulletin to all counties regarding the sex registration of a juvenile in Sauk County.
It would only be for the county where the juvenile resides.
That's exactly what I thought. And so what is this all about? The county in which he resides, Sauk County, already knows of the adjudication, right? Because the county knows all that information. Ashland County doesn't know about Sauk County. The sex registry, as you say, because it's juvenile, you don't put it on the Internet. And also, as you're just telling me, Ash, there's no way for the department to disseminate the information other than the Internet, which is precluded from doing, to Ashland County if it happens in Sauk County. So this just seems much ado about absolutely nothing. I must be wrong. You must be here for a reason. Tell me what it is.
But if the juvenile moves to another county, then that information will be provided to the county where the juvenile moves. That is the purpose for the local law enforcement to be aware of the juveniles that are.
Okay, so the mother, the kid is 11 years old and has a mother and one other sibling who's 8. And the mother, they live in Sauk County. They live there for a year and a half, and then she decides to move. Is she required to run down to the police department or the sheriff's department? I mean, maybe she is. I don't need to ask this. And say, we are moving to Marinette, and we're going to be moving July 25th. I just wanted you to know. Is she required to do that?
Well, the juvenile, and obviously the parent would take on the responsibility often, is required to inform the Department of Corrections. Okay. And Corrections then has the duty to inform the local area where they're
And
moving.
If the mother doesn't?
Then the juvenile would face criminal penalties under 301.45 for failing to register.
The 10-year-old, not the mother?
The juvenile, yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hirsch? Ms. Hirsch, what's this all about if it's not public?
Well, it isn't public in Wisconsin. There's so many permutations of this in the discussion that we've been having about policy. Let me just say a couple things. Cesar G's position. Cesar G had to go down to the police station and have his mugshot taken and his fingerprint taken for his sex offender registry so that the Department of Corrections would have that. He actually moved at one point during his, while he was, he's still registered, but he moved at one point to Texas. And when you move out of state, you have to follow that state's registration requirements. So in Texas, the law enforcement officials were notified and the school district was notified. If he had moved to Missouri, it would have gone on the Internet. If he had moved to Washington State, it would have gone on the Internet. And so his ability to go anywhere to another state is now controlled to some extent for the next 15 years of his life about his sex offender registry and whether he wants this information to be public. I call the Corrections, Department of Corrections, because it's not clear to me under 301.46 AG whether when he turns 18 this becomes public information or not. They said they treat it still as private, confidential information, although they can't assure us that law enforcement officials do that as well, that law enforcement is sometimes less aware of where it comes from and has been known to make this public. And every time he moves, every time he changes schools, which of course you do when you move from middle school to high school to college, Every time he buys a car, he has to go tell the people who run the registry, and if he doesn't, he's subject to criminal penalties. And so this move for his family to Texas required a lot of coordination. And then he called me recently and said, now I have a notice that I have to go to the police department at 10 o'clock on Wednesday morning to have my picture taken. What's that about? I tracked it down, and it was for a mugshot for his registration information. I pointed out to his social worker that he was 13 and had school obligations at 10 o'clock, and she rescheduled it. So this is a real detriment to these children as they go through life. And, you know, I've never moved so often in my life since I finished college as I did during those period of adolescence and early adulthood, which is when they're getting affected by these things. Secondly, I think I want to mention, when you talk about this discretion and it being treated differently around the state, if this court finds that it's absolutely mandatory and the trial court does not have discretion in these cases, what has happened in counties where that was what they thought earlier, before Daniel T., is that really the discretion moves to the attorneys at the charging stage. And so it moves out of the court, and we start talking about fourth-degree sexual assault, which is not a registration offense. We start talking about consent decrees. And so you're really pushing discretion. You're saying trial judges have no discretion, and so you're pushing it into prosecuting attorneys and defense attorneys for discussions and negotiations. And that has happened. I just want one more thing. I'm sorry, my time is up, is that Justice Abramson, in the appendix of my brief, you will find a very typical dispositional order. And it specifically has one provision that says, Department of Corrections, this is stayed. And I think anybody who looks at typical juvenile court orders will find that almost always, if there's a stay provision, it applies to one provision, one of the dispositions, and not to the entire order. And so I think that you'll see that Kendall G. was correct on that point, not the Daniel T. court.
So you're telling me that the judge will state one or more provisions, but not the entire order. Where is that? It's a four-page form.
Let me just find it quick.
If I'm looking at the right form.
If you look at the third page.
One, two, three. Okay.
The very first, they have provision, Cesar shall be placed in secure correctional at Pinkin Hills. This order shall be stayed.
Okay.
Very typical, and these are not limited to
that.
And they are not limited to corrections. They use them for secure detention. They use them for suspension of driver's licenses. They sometimes do this. It's typical. We see them frequently.
So that Cesar is responsible for $25 victim witness fee stay, I shouldn't use that word. That's still in effect, even though part of this order has been stayed.
That's correct.
So where does it say he shall be registered?
That's down on the list, the third from the bottom.
Okay. So it's all part of the same thing. In your position, they could have stayed that provision, too.
Absolutely.
You just put or this order shall be stayed.
And probably any one of these provisions on this page.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wittenberger, and thank you, Ms. Hirsch, for excellent arguments today on a juvenile issue relating to the registration. Arguments that detail a lot of statutes with numbers are difficult for both counsel and for the court, and for people who have to listen. So we appreciate your effort. That concludes our hearing on 02-2106. We'll take a few moments recess, so if the students want to leave, they may. I just call your attention to that. Everyone's invited to the noon session with Justice Robinsack. It's not limited to the students. We are in recess.